Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Julia Witt up with Talk Story Radio, and we have with us this morning mystery writer Billy Turner, who is going to tell us a little bit about his writing career and about his newest book called A Murder in Our Mists. So, Billy, hi.
How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm excited to hear about your book. So why don't you tell us a little bit about how you came to write this book?
When I was in college, my professor had written over the top of the paper, "It is amazing at the high rate of illiteracy in the United States." I went dashing to Brother Ward and Brother Newman, asking them, "What is he talking about?" And they looked at the paper. They said, "What he's telling you is that you don't have style. The paper's technically correct." I said, "Well, how can I get style?" And they thought for a moment. They said, "Well, go and read some murder mysteries." That Saturday, I had gone to the library, and I spent the entire day reading murder mysteries, flipping through Agatha Christie. And when I went back that Monday, I was ready. And little did I realize that by flipping through those pages, I had been influenced by Agatha Christie. And I had read an article in Times, I think, where people were trying to smuggle thoroughbred, the embryos of thoroughbreds from South America in the embryo of a rabbit. And I said, "Oh, that's intriguing." And I started jotting down some things and all of this. And checking with an expert, a veterinarian, I said, "Is it feasible to put the embryos of snakes in a horse?" That veterinarian called me everything imaginable, that I was cruel, insensitive. Why would you want to do that to a snake? And it developed from there. And with the story, it's most opportune now. Raymond Babant was the son of a billionaire. And Robert Winchell was the son of a postman. They met at Harvard. And the only thing that they had in common was the state of California. And as a man of color entering Harvard, Winchell quickly learned that to make friends, he must first be one. He and Raymond became the best of buddies. Unfortunately, Robert's family died, and the Babants more or less took him in. After graduation from college, Raymond went to work for his father, and Robert became an L.A. PD police officer, having been passed over for what he thought were deserved promotions. He became disgruntled and left and went to England. He, although his letters were cheerful, Raymond sensed that something was wrong because they had become so close. They were just like brothers. And using their influence, they found out that Robert had run into the same bigotry in England. Raymond's family, using their international influence, got him a job with Scotland Yard. Robert handled a case for the Queen, Queen most delicately, and she knighted him. Everything was going swimmingly, and Robert receives a letter from Raymond. "I want you to come right away. Someone in my family is trying to kill me." Robert dropped everything, literally, and flew back to Pasadena. And when he arrived, he had indeed arrived too late. His friend had died. And he was told that he had turned. And he turned around, man. He was really taken aback. They told him that Raymond had cancer, and unable to deal with it, he took strychnine. Raymond said, "Oh, no, I know him. He wouldn't have done anything like that. He might have made you kill yourself, but you would. He would not do this. And he was put on notice because the family had closed ranks. And what was really disconcerting was that his investigation was with Raymond's family, and a family that had taken him in. And that put them at a distance. It was discomforting for Raymond, all of this. And, I mean, for Robert. But at any rate, when Robert began to investigate, his investigation turned up different murders committed by different culprits, but with a common motive. And the book would keep you guessing until the very end.
What the motive is? Or?
Yeah, what the motive is. And who did it? Who set everything into motion?
Wow. Okay. And, oh my, I'm sorry about that. Let me unplug that phone.
Okay.
So you are going to make a series, right?
Yes, I am. And the one that's almost completed, I think I have a chapter left, Death Comes for the President. And a synopsis is that the president had gone on an economic summit. He had visited China, an economic summit.
Really?
And yes, and he had gone to China, and he had gone to Turkey.
I'm not sure what's happened here. We've lost sound with Billy, and I don't know if he even realizes it. I'm not getting any sound anyway.
I can hear you.
Billy?
Yes.
Okay. I'm going to Billy and hope that he calls back in. Hi, Billy. Hi, Billy. Are you still there? Hi, Billy.
Hi.
Good. Oh, I don't know what happened. You went dead and then I went dead. I called back. Did you call back or were you there all along?
I was there all along and you said, I hope he calls back. And that's when I called back. But with the dead sound, I could still hear you.
Oh, so maybe everybody could. Oh, my goodness. Okay, well, we still have 20 minutes left, so let's go on. And maybe we can either redo this or just let it run the way it is. It's making an automatic recording.
Okay. Well, now, what we were saying was this. My sequel is Death Comes for the President. The president had gone on an economic summit to China and to Turkey and other places. And he was addressing the inequity of the trade. And when the plane returned to the United States, they tried to rouse the president, and they couldn't. And they found out that he was dead. He was immediately taken to Walter Reed, and they determined that he had been poisoned. It was a beloved president, and the United States wanted to retaliate. But what they did, they wanted cooler heads to prevail. So they hired the detective, Sir Robert Winchell, to investigate, to retrace the president's trip. And they determined the poison, and where did he ingest it? And everything pointed to Turkey. But prior to that, there were 5 murders at Walter Reed that had gone unsolved. Robert wanted to find out why these things weren't done. And he told the D.C. police chief of homicide, he says, the deceased, if they had met with foul play, were like the person caught and justice served. But those who have met with foul play and their demises could have been prevented, they're angry. Am I making myself clear to you? And the D.C. chief of police dropped his head. And so it like it had gone reverse. He was looking at the deaths in Walter Reed and the death in, of the president. And he and they were telling him, there is no connection. But Winchell says, you know what, I think there is. And he kept pursuing it and all of this. And then when he goes back and back and his mind is revolving back and forth, it was vacillating. Death of the president, death at the hospital. And what he uncovers shocks the United States and the world. Who was responsible for the death of the president? That's it in brevity. And had he been looking through my window, you would have said he's schizophrenic because I'm walking through and right up with the dialogue, I would dash to the computer and start writing and all of this. And the reason it's taken so long, I had to find a bridge that would connect the two.
The two
and
books?
The two murders.
Oh, okay. Okay, but the two books are not connected.
No.
Okay. So each individual book will be a standalone mystery.
Yes, it will be.
Just
the others
the
that
same
I have,
investigator.
Right. The others that I have outlined is that two corpses beneath the tree. And that is set in England. And Winchell is on vacation. And he and the chief inspector were talking. He says, I'm a little bit baffled. And all of this, they seem to be upstanding citizens. And Winchell starts investigating and assisting because the chief inspector says, I just can't find a motive or anyone who would possibly have done it. And Winchell puts his skills to work and comes up with a culprit.
In consult with who?
With the chief inspector.
And did you say culprit?
Yes.
So the chief inspector was the murderer?
No.
No. Okay. So how do you work? That was interesting when you said you dash to the computer. Tell us a little bit about how you work.
Well, I tell you what, I'm a very lazy worker and writer. Is that I don't commence writing a book until it has fully developed in my mind. I have it unfolds, the next step, and the next step, and then I will fill in the little brief spots. And then while I'm doing it, I will go to the computer and outline it. Only so much stuff can go in a bag until you have to close it. And doing an outline precludes you from just running over and all of this. And waiting for the mind to turn around and fully develop the story, the plot, the setting, and all of this is that you allow it to ferment and develop. That precludes, for me, brain lock and all of this. And so I know exactly
now,
where I'm
going.
Now,
doesn't the outline do that? Doesn't the outline close it off prematurely also, or no?
No, it just gives you a guideline. You turn around and you say, you know what? Like the two corpses beneath the tree. You visualize that, and then you visualize what led up to who discovered it. And then you find Winchell coming to England, and then him meeting with his old buddy his friend, Sir Robert Winchell, and he's discussing the case, and he says, I'm baffled. I don't know how they were murdered, who killed them. And it doesn't seem to be any motive for this. They were quiet, reserved, and all of this. And Winchell tells him, said, you know what, people are not just randomly murdered. And so Winchell more or less
actually,
takes
they sometimes
over.
Are.
Right, but you know, the thing too is this. We're not talking just a random murders. We're talking upscale. And so the thing too is this, is that Winchell pretty much takes over the investigation. And a person's demise more than likely can be traced to their activities. What were they doing?
Mm-hmm.
And what brought this on? And then so Robert initiates this and uncovers a clever plot, a scenario that set into motion the two individuals' demise.
So your
and,
mind works, you do the I'm trying to understand how, so your mind works on trying to make things fit into the outline that you've put down.
Well, the outline just serves as a guide where you want to go, how you want to get there. But while you're doing it, it'll take twists and turns. You're writing to intrigue. You want a credible plot. You want credible citizens. If people would think along the lines of Perry Mason, they say that Perry Mason was fictional, was an excellent attorney. But if you look close enough, it was his investigator, Paul Drake. Paul Drake served up the evidence that Perry Mason presented to the court. And so,
right.
And so when you look at it, it's that, how do you get your evidence and all of this? In this case, Winchell has a sidekick who has been taken from the first book. Detective Dennis admired Winchell so. He never had any friends. And his superior was African-American, the same as Robert Winchell. And he told him, he says, one thing you two have in common, you are both African-Americans. And that is where it stops. And it was envy.
So in other words, they had nothing else in common.
Right. Winchell was groomed. Winchell was educated. Winchell was knighted. Winchell was a celebrated detective. And what he admired was Winchell's devotion to Raymond. And he envied that friendship. He never had a friend, and he wanted to be a friend like that, with something paralleling it. And it was a little bit awkward because Winchell was not looking for a replacement. Raymond had been definitive. And as Winchell did not have jurisdiction in California, he had to team up with Detective Dennis. And so Dennis was valuable, more or less, in taking Winchell around and all of this to the different areas.
And gradually taking over his friend's place.
Yes.
Aha.
And it was, and I think that the book is more germane now, is that when we look at the TV and the news, the news media is serving as a divisive means that Caucasians and African Americans are at each other's throats. That is not true. It is the issue is between African Americans and the police departments and the police officers, and they're just
and the issue is between the poor and the rich in a way. I mean, there's poor people are being...
You know, I'm going to tell you something. My mother, when she put us in a private school, a private elementary school, private high school, she was working as a maid. When we took the graduate and took the SAT, the PSAT exams, we scored in the thousands and all of this. We went to the best universities at that particular time. And now it's like African Americans have abandoned those principles, particularly here in California. They were offered vouchers to put their kids in private schools, charter schools, and all of this. But whatever the reason, because it baffles me, they turned it down. There are these quick affluent avenues that they want to pursue, specifically rapping and all of this. Well, everybody can probably rap, but you don't have that talent to set you apart. And not everybody who aspires to be a rapper will succeed. And it's like the alternative would be to sell drugs. And you think you're going to make a retirement income from this. It's like they have lost their way. And with the police,
well, you know, your mother, your mother knew that, but the girls that are coming up now and putting their kids in school don't know that.
But that's just the thing. It's like a vicious cycle. They themselves are on, I think, what's the guy's name? Jesse Jackson. He says children having children, 13,
yes.
14, 15, getting pregnant. No guidance. They end up on welfare. Then their children are doing the same thing. They don't have any guidance in all of this. Everybody makes mistakes. But do you keep making the same mistake over and over? The best thing is to explain this. A guy comes along and tells you he loves you. You believe him. You have sex, you have a baby, he marches off. The next guy comes along, he tells you he loves you. You say, well, the first guy lied to me. Perhaps this one is telling me the truth. He gets you pregnant, he marches off. Then the third guy comes along, I love you, let's skip this. And let's get to the bed or whatever. You know, the thing, too, is this. I've been lied to. I've been cheated on and all of this. When are you going to wake up? When are you going to take responsibility for your actions? When I became a mystery writer, I received so many rejection notices. Even now, rejection notices are identical. Not suited. Good luck. And all of this. You can't be thin-skinned. You got to be persistent, and you got to be able to write on a level because the publishers want you to be able to compete with established writers. There are no ladies up.
Learn to work hard.
Yeah,
but that's the part
and then,
where
you know,
they're
if you
getting messed up.
Right, and so you know, your field might not be writing; it might be something else. But to be persistent, to be able to drive and not be afraid of being stopped. And when you are stopped, you don't say why, how come. You comply. You put your hands up, or if you have to get down on the ground, you do that because your chances are that you will walk away from that alive because it is not. Okay.
I was concerned the other day about how my grandson sometimes talks to people and he thinks it's funny, but I thought, gee, he could get shot talking to a policeman like that.
Right. You know, I did an article on the police shootings. We don't hear anything about the Klan per se before they were high profile, shaven heads and all of this. And my church members and I, we would always go to breakfast after services, and we would talk about any and everything. And I said, well, you know what? I think that those people have gotten into the police departments, and those are the ones who are doing the shootings and all of this. And it's Texas, Florida, Chicago,
mm-hmm.
and I think it's New York. And so people are so quick to forget that people just don't randomly stop and be murdered, per se. In Chicago and New York, they said that they have the five families, the mafia clan. They would turn around and give the contract to the police officer, who would turn around and stop you because they have no choice but to stop, kill you, and keep going. Who's the wiser? But the American people just turn around and they say, well, African-Americans, African-Americans, deadbeat dads, African-Americans, prostitutes, whores, African-American women, dropouts and all of this, African-Americans. And one thing that I found most troubling, one of my co-workers had asked me, so why is there animosity between African-American and Jews? I said, simple. When the Jews were in the camps, the Nazis had used the media against them to desensitize the Germans so it would be easier to kill them.
Mm-hmm.
I said, now, the Jews said, well, the media will never be used against us ever again. So what they did when they got to Hollywood and started making the movies and all of this, what did they do? They made movies.
They bought the media.
Right. They bought the media, and then they portrayed African-Americans as buffoons, idiots, and all of this. And then they ran a series of movies and all of this about African-Americans. The only way they got to college was through affirmative action. When they got there, they couldn't stay because they could not handle the casework. They ran this over and over and over until the people just digested it. And then, but it is so traumatic. Here they are using the same thing that was used against them. And the people don't
mm-hmm.
see this and realize it. You must stand on the backs of someone else to turn around and say, look how grand I am, and all of this. And then if you were to tell the Jews or make a statement that there weren't 6 million Jews in Europe in the camps, they would just cause you to lose your job and all of this. Well, there were censors during that particular time. And
well, we need to have evolved to the point where we realize we're all human.
That's just
and
it.
And we don't have to turn on each other.
Right. And but they turn around and they don't see this, the brotherhood. And I was trying to show, well, it wasn't deliberate, but it just turned that way, was that the friendship between Raymond Bavant and Robert Winchell, they were closer than brothers. But one thing in society is that men are not allowed to have men friends. It's an exclusive hell only for women. The husband is saying, where are you going? I'm going over to my girlfriends. We're going to sit down and talk and all of this. No, you're not. Yes, I am. I'm going. And walks out the door. A man tells his wife, hey, look, I'm going over to my buddy's house. For what? You're not walking out that door. If you walk out, you're not coming back. What's going on between the two of you? And then so...
You should think about turning your writing to some of these subjects too, Billy.
It's the double standard. And I look at it when I was teaching. I was teaching about the Scarlet Letter by Nathaniel Hawthorne. And I said, I want you to tell me, where do you think he might have gotten this plot, the clue from? And I want you to touch on the Baroness, that they found the woman and brought her before Jesus, but they didn't do this for the man. And so the girls just ran with it. I'm Baroness and all of this. And so I can just see it. I would like to do a modern version of that. They turn around.
I would like
woman.
To see you do that. You know our show already ended. We're just talking now. I don't know exactly where it ended, but we'll have to play the recording and find out. It's automatic. But, I'd like to see you cover some of those subjects, too. Maybe you could expand into some of that, because the world desperately needs, you know... The world desperately needs to hear some viewpoint other than what we're getting.
But you know what, and I won't tie you up, is that very few, well, the face of America is changing, and African Americans in high school, they are not aware that the studios have internships and that it will be available for them to get their foot in the door and write
well,
and be trained.
Well, I know all of that. I'm from a poor family, and I went to school on grants to college.
Mm-hmm.
But most of my relatives didn't know that such things existed.
Right.
They didn't
go
to college because they didn't know that grants were available.
Right. And they didn't have the teachers to tell them that, you know, we have this available and all of this. And the teachers, the high school teachers, are aware, very much aware, of this child's desire to go to college. They know the financial situation of the family. And they can tell them, hey, look, you want to go here and you don't have the money,
well,
the grant, and all
this. Well, they should be telling them way earlier because they don't even think to want to go to college because they think it's an impossible dream.
Right. And then on top of this, I remember my contemporaries, it's not important to speak good grammar because we don't want to talk like the white man. And one woman, she made this statement. She says, no one drops from the womb speaking perfect grammar. You have to be taught. And it was Sister Agnes Burnett who had said, they said something, and one of the students said, it ain't right. She says, well, first of all, you're supposed to say it isn't right. And if you sit there and close your mouth, I'll explain why. And that was the catalyst for me. She was my mentor, and nothing grieved me more than when one of the nuns, when I inquired about her, said, I have some sad news. What's that? She's dead. I said, what? And that's why I dedicated the book to her and my mother, my deceased wife, and all of this. But it's just the idea that someone takes an interest and makes sure that you are pushed through. One of the instructors was a nun, and she was just mean, absolutely mean. I couldn't put my hand on it. And then recently, most recently, I understand that she had withdrawn from the convent. She's in the secular world now. I think she realized that she wasn't supposed to be there as a nun.
She wasn't suited for that. Yeah,
exactly. And people don't realize this. You know, you think that the nuns are sweet and holy and cuddly, and they are women going through menopause and everything else. And then they got to deal with you.
No, I've heard some horror stories about nuns in school.
Yeah.
I didn't go to Catholic school, but I've heard them from my friends.
Yeah, they weren't your friends. But you had to catch them on a good day and sit there with your mouth closed. Hands folded. And so back in Boston, you're walking on the playground and you got your hands in your pocket, and because it's cold, they walk up and smack you. What's that for? Because you're playing with yourself. What? That's, oh my God. That's,
they
let
just
me get
automatically
out of here.
Assume it's something bad. Anything
right.
You could be and, doing something bad.
Right. It is, but you know, it is quite valuable because they knew their subject and they imparted it. The nuns were not scientists, and they gingerly taught that. Males are more involved in science now than they were. We didn't have any. We had one who taught biology, but everything else was handled by the nuns. And so they made sure we got it. And I'll never forget.
I always thought. Writing was one of the most important things you can teach kids because look at all the stuff that depends on your being able to express yourself in writing.
But you know, I tell you what, I forget the year it was, but corporate America had issued a statement that Johnny is coming out of college unable to write a memo. And
yeah.
White America said, You know, that might very well be. But our sons that are coming after, I can assure you, they will be able to do. And that was when the whites were they took their kids out of the public school system and put them in private school.
Yeah.
And they haven't returned. They realized the problem. They made the sacrifices or got the subsidies or whatever. And their kids are excelling. And we're always told that Asians have the best minds. But they don't tell you that 8,000 documented Asians were expelled from Ivy League colleges and universities for cheating.
Really?
Yes.
Wow. No, I didn't know that. I thought it was just because they pushed their kids so hard. Well, that's probably why they're cheating, too, because they're pushed
so
hard.
Right, to keep up. Right. And so they turn around. Now, they got in there, but could they stay without cheating? No. But the media doesn't address that. There was an article about it, and then it was just, that was the end of it. They don't want to offend China or the Japanese. They don't want to cast aspersions on, they have the best minds. If you have the best minds, there's no reason for you to cheat.
Right.
And it was an article that says that too many students are getting A's out of Harvard. And how can an Asian master English when it has so many nuances?
Mm-hmm.
But somehow And so you don't question that. You say, well, they just got better minds. Oh, no. I have a degree in English. And the nuances of it, and in writing and in all of this, the continuity of sentence transition and all of this. But it takes training. And then even with the degree, you got to stop and think, well, is this right? And all of this. And so, but they come and they take the SAT and they get a perfect score. There is no way in hell for them to do this.
Yeah, that's interesting.
It's just like an American learning Cantonese. And then they turn around and then you go there and you're going to compete with the people who are Chinese. They say, oh, no.
No, that's not.
Right. I don't know. Huh. I enjoyed this.
Well, yes, I did too. So let me know when you get your next book out and we'll do it again.
Okay, I'll do that. And thank you for interviewing me.
Thank you. Bye, Billy.
Bye-bye.